Woo, those lights come up fast at the end of that. I always think I'm ready, and I never am. Glad that you are here this morning. My name is DJ. I'm a youth pastor here at Genesis, and it is my pleasure to welcome you this morning. Yes, Ryan is out of town this week, you guessed correctly, and so we're excited that he gets to go and be on vacation and hang out with his lovely wife, and they are in England for a few days. So you get me this week and you get Jesse next week, and it's going to be a couple of great weeks. And then Ryan will be back to hit us on the home stretch of Acts. So that little video that you just watched is almost to an end. Yeah. You're going to miss it? Yeah, okay. All right. Some of you are going to miss it. Some of you are like, yeah, it's cool. Yeah. Wrap it up. All right. So I want to start this morning by talking to you about one of my favorite subjects, motorcycle racing. Yes. Because, you know, there's just a lot of parallels from life to racing. And so I'm just going to keep giving it to you. Sorry. It's just who I am. It's what I bring to the table. So the guy you see on the screen is a guy, he's an Australian named Mick Doohan. And he is one of the most successful motorcycle racers of all time on a Grand Prix championship level. So like all over Europe, all over the world, these guys race, and they're pretty crazy. He lived in an era that was extremely dangerous because the motorcycles didn't have traction control and they had way too much power for the tires that they had. And so you would get spit off of them at random times in the most violent ways possible. Yeah, sounds a lot of fun, doesn't it? And Mick looks older than he is in this picture, and I'm about to tell you why. So in 1992, he was a very young guy, and he was leading the championship at the time, and they were racing in the Netherlands. And he had a pretty terrible accident, and he ended up with a spiral fracture in his leg, which, if any of you know anything about that, that's not a good way to fracture anything. It creates splinters and a lot of damage to bone and muscle and all of those things. And so Mick gets transferred to a local hospital, and they take x-rays and they see what's going on with his leg, and the surgeon says, you know, okay, we have to do surgery. And he's like, well, you know, are you any good at this? And he says, the surgeon says, I went to medical school. I did just as well as everyone else. There's no one else in the country that's any better than me. And he's like, that doesn't reassure me, but okay, this is what he's got, right? So they have the surgery, things don't go well. Mick ends up with a terrible, terrible infection in his legs, and he is, I don't wanna describe it to you because I know some of you are like me, you're a little bit queasy. I don't even wanna talk about it because it's so gross. But anyway, he is in danger of losing his leg. And it comes out through all of this, through a few days while he's in the hospital, that this doctor is vehemently opposed to motorcycle racing. He thinks it's incredibly dangerous. He thinks these guys are putting themselves at risk unnecessarily. And so there is now question of what his motivation is in healing Mick. And so he's in a hospital bed. The doctor's telling him, we have no choice but to amputate your leg. And he's realizing like his career, his whole livelihood is over. It seems as though hope is lost. But there is a doctor who travels with all of these racers. His name is Claudio Costa, and he becomes very famous, although at this point he's pretty early in his career. But he becomes very famous because he does all of these wild kind of experimental things to keep riders on the racetrack. Now, later on, he gets criticized because sometimes he puts riders out who really shouldn't be. Like, he'll patch you up just enough to get you going, and you really shouldn't be out there. But at this point, he's still early, and so nobody really knows what his potential is going to be. So he shows up at the hospital, and he realizes what's happening. And so he kidnaps Mick and another racer named Kevin, takes them back to Italy, and says, I've got this handled. I'll take care of you. I'll do what needs to be done. And so in a crazy experimental surgery, he attaches Mick's good leg to his bad leg because he has lost blood flow to the area of the injury. And so he casts them together for 10 days in order to create, to jumpstart Mick's system into healing his own leg. It's this wild, crazy thing that never would have happened if he hadn't walked in and intervened in this situation. Mick was completely without hope until Dr. Costa walked in the room and said, "You're coming with me and I'm gonna fix this." Now, it takes many, many months and many more surgeries, in fact, almost a full year for Mick to get back to full health. But he eventually becomes this multi-time world champion and one of the greatest racers who's ever lived because of his experience with that. If you want to, you can look it up online. If you look up Mick Doohan, there's pictures of his scars and there's more about the story. It's this wild, crazy experience. But Mick went from leading the championship before this accident to wondering within 3 days if he was even gonna retain both of his legs. I mean, you can imagine what kind of hope-draining moment sitting in that hospital bed would be for him. Yeah, so we're gonna look at a story today that also has some pretty hope-draining consequences. Around here we use the YouVersion Bible app. You can check it out under the More tab. You can get to events and you can follow along with all of our, with all of the scripture and all of the points that I'm gonna make this morning. And then you can also find questions for your small group later if you're interested in rehashing the sermon later on and deciding whether I did a good job or not in your small groups. I know. You guys love me. I love that about this place. It's a good thing. So we are going to jump into Acts 27. And just as a reminder, the story of Acts is about the early church, and Paul is instrumental in the early church. And so Paul is building up the church, but he has come to a point where he has ruffled too many feathers. And so he has declared that after being arrested, he needs to go in front of Caesar and decide his fate and decide the fate of Jesus's influence on the Roman Empire from there. So Paul is on his journey to Rome, and we are about to see his next step in that. So in Acts 27, we're going to start with verses 1 and go through 3, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about it. When the time came, we set sail for Italy. Paul and several other prisoners were placed in the custody of a Roman officer named Julius, a captain of the Imperial Regiment. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was also with us. We left on a ship whose home port was Adramyttium, on the northwest coast of the province of Asia. It was scheduled to make several stops at ports along the coast of the province. The next day, when we docked at Sidon, Julius was very kind to Paul and let him go ashore to visit with friends so they could provide for his needs. Nice. Yeah, a couple of big words in there. Jane wasn't sure if I could suss those out today, but we made it. The first thing I want you to notice is this use of we, right? What is happening at the very beginning of this story? Well, who do we know is the author of Acts? Anybody know? Luke, that's right. So Luke is on this journey with Paul. Okay, we get this firsthand account view of what's about to happen to Paul and his friend Aristarchus, who was also around with him when he was arrested because of the mob and the riots and all of that stuff. So you have a couple of guys here who have been intimately involved with Paul, and now they're going on this journey with him, probably not knowing exactly what it was gonna be like. Paul is put into the care of a guy who's in charge of 100 centurions, and so he is a pretty high-ranking officer, and he has the charge of Paul. Now, it's pretty amazing that he allows Paul to go ashore, probably out of his custody, to visit with his friends, because in Roman times, if you were in charge of a prisoner, and if that prisoner was lost or escaped somehow, guess who got to serve his sentence? You. Yeah, so the centurion would have been not only in charge of Paul, he would have been responsible for his sentence. Now, Paul doesn't have a sentence yet because he's yet to go in front of Caesar. But, I mean, ultimately, he's really looking at a charge that could mean death. So the centurion is kind of rolling the dice here. Or he realizes that Paul is trustworthy and that he can lean on him to do the right thing when the time comes. All right, we're going to go even deeper into this story, and we got a couple of long sections of reading to do, but I want you to know that at the end is the good stuff. I also want you to know that I'm skipping a bunch of details that I really, really want to tell you about this morning, but we don't have time because I know you don't want to be here and listen to me talk about this for an hour and a half. So hang in there with me. Let's read this, and then we'll get to breaking it down at the end. So in verse 4, it says, putting out to sea from there, we encountered strong headwinds that made it difficult to keep the ship on course. So we sailed north of Cyprus between the island and the mainland. Keeping to the open sea, we passed along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, landing at Myra in the province of Lycia. There, the commanding officer found an Egyptian ship from Alexandria that was bound for Italy, and he put us on board. We had several days of slow sailing, and after great difficulty, we finally neared Cnidus. But the wind was against us, so we sailed across to Crete and along the sheltered coast of the island past the Cape of Salmon. We struggled along the coast with great difficulty and finally arrived at Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. We had lost a lot of time. The weather was becoming dangerous for sea travel because it was so late in the fall, and Paul spoke to the ship's officers about it. Men, he said, I believe there is trouble ahead if we go on. Shipwreck, loss of cargo, danger to our lives as well. But the officer in charge of the prisoners listened more to the ship's captain and the owner than to Paul. And since Fair Havens was an exposed harbor, a poor place to spend the winter, most of the crew wanted to go on to Phoenix, farther up the coast of Crete, and spend the winter there. Phoenix was a good harbor with only a southwest and northwest exposure. So, back to Julius, the centurion, back to the captain, the crew. They're all very experienced in the sea. And we need to remember that these guys were afraid of the sea, for sure. They sailed close to the coasts because they didn't want to end up out in an area where they couldn't see land, because it could be hard to navigate. It could be hard to be out in an open sea, especially if big storms and swells came up and those kinds of things. So they understood the sea. They were afraid of it. But they're also, their economic livelihood was directly tied to the sea. When you look at what's happening, they're paying for passage, they're transporting goods. Their whole experience of life, in some ways, is wrapped around moving things across the sea. There was no good way to go on land to get where they needed to go. So they understood that they had to go through the sea. It wasn't something that they could skip. And Paul, we know, right, that Julius allowed him ashore, so he has some level of respect. But in the end, the economics outweigh the common sense that Paul seems to be giving them. See, and there is a kind of a fun little detail here, too. Fair Havens was a pretty small place, so not only was it a bad harbor, but it would have been exceedingly boring. Like, no one wanted to spend the winter there because there's absolutely nothing to do, right? There's no Suns playoff basketball, although there could be argued there's not much Suns basketball happening right now in Phoenix. There was nothing for them to do in Fairhaven. So they were afraid of what would happen to the ship, and they were afraid of what would happen to them because of boredom. Paul also has lots of experience, though. So Paul is not speaking here like naively or not understanding what's going on. At this point, he would have been on 11 journeys and crossed 3,500 miles of ocean in his life. He talks about this in 2 Corinthians. He says, 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. Once I spent a whole night and a day adrift at sea. Paul has experienced the sea. He knows a little bit of what he speaks about. If you had spent a night and a day adrift at sea, you probably would advise, hey, don't take that chance. I don't really want to look forward to another shipwreck and another night and a day at sea. That makes sense? Yeah, 100%, 100%. But they don't listen. They decide they need to make their money and they need to have an exciting winter. So on we go in verse 13. When a light wind began blowing from the south, the sailors thought they could make it. So they pulled up anchor and sailed close to the shore of Crete. But the weather changed abruptly, and a wind of typhoon strength, called a northeaster, burst across the island and blew us out to sea. The sailors couldn't turn the ship into the wind, so they gave up and let it run before the gale. We sailed along the sheltered side of a small island named Cauda, where with great difficulty we hoisted aboard the lifeboat being towed behind us. If you have to bring the lifeboat in, that's not a good sign. Then the sailors bound ropes around the hull of the ship to strengthen it. They were afraid of being driven across to the sandbars of Syrtis off the African coast. So they lowered the sea anchor to slow the ship and were driven before the wind. The next day, as gale force winds continued to batter the ship, the crew began throwing the cargo overboard. The following day, they even took some of the ship's gear, threw it overboard. The terrible storm raged for many days, blotting out the sun and the stars, until at last all hope was gone. It's a pretty dire situation they're in. I mean, when you look at what they're doing, they pull in the lifeboat in anticipation of needing it, right? They start tying the ship together because it's getting beat up so badly. And then they throw the cargo overboard. Now, at this point, this voyage is completely wasted. They would have needed that cargo in order to pay for sailing all the way there. So they have given up hope of this being a successful mission, and now they're just trying to survive. The storm has ripped away any chance of thriving, and they're just putting their heads down trying to figure out how are we going to make it onto dry land. They throw out stuff that they need to sail the ship. This is over, right? This voyage is the biggest failure possible. There's nothing left. And here's the thing. This would have been a big ship that regularly made this voyage. It talked about being from Egypt, from Alexandria. So Rome, especially, would have been a very large city, maybe a million people, maybe just over a million people. And the problem with that is, how do you feed all those people? When there's not farmland nearby or any of those things, you have to move large amounts of food in order to keep those people fed. And so this ship was a grain ship that would have been bringing food to Rome that was necessary. It would have been very well compensated, very well paid for. It was an important thing. And these ships were built to handle that grain. They didn't sit very low in the water because they were wide and all of that. And they were strongly built, but the problem is that they were made to go with the wind only. And so if the wind hits it the wrong direction, it can't sail. It's not like those sailboats that you see, you know, racing, where they, you know, kind of, it's called tacking into the wind or whatever. I don't really know about this. I grew up around people who sailed, but I'm not a boat guy. So I just know that the sailboat turns and it, like, kind of gets hit by the wind, and then you use the rudder and something else to make it steer. That all happens. But apparently this boat can't do that, okay? So anytime the wind is opposing the boat, it's just at the mercy of the wind. Has no rudder. Two guys would have paddles at the back and steer it. For a big ship, that doesn't sound very like a very successful way to sail, right? Some of you later are going to tell me all the things I need to know about sailing, and I'll appreciate that. My eyes might glaze over just a little bit like yours are right now. So they are fighting a losing battle, and they know it. They know that their hope is gone. What happens next? Verse 21. No one had eaten for a long time. This is a tragedy. Finally, Paul called the crew together and said, "Men, you should have listened to me in the first place and not left Crete. You would have avoided all this damage and loss. But take courage. None of you will lose your lives, even though the ship will go down. For last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me, and he said, 'Don't be afraid, Paul, for you will surely stand trial before Caesar. What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. So take courage, for I believe God. It will be just as he said, but we will be shipwrecked on an island.'" Now listen, I don't want you to hear Paul at the very beginning chastising these guys, okay? That wasn't his point. I think what Paul is trying to do here is draw attention to the fact that he had warned them, but he is also on this journey with them. He knows intimately what has been happening with this boat from the very beginning. Paul is not saying, "Oh, it's no big deal, take heart, everything's gonna be fine." Paul is saying, "Hey, listen, I get it. We have been on this journey together. I know the situation that we're in just as much as you do. I am fully invested in the despair that we are all facing." But he brings hope to this situation. Paul is trying to do something here to show them that it's not time to give up yet, because that would have been what it felt like. They have nothing left. They can barely manage to stay aboard the ship, let alone steer it or try to get where they're going or do anything useful, right? So for us, what does this mean? What does this passage mean for us when we face difficulties and storms in our lives? Well, I believe it's this. Surviving the storm means we need to become hope markers for God's kingdoms. Let's revisit the story from the beginning, right? Mick, Dr. Costa. Mick is lying there in a hospital with this hostile surgeon telling him, "Look, you have no hope. I'm going to take your leg because that's the only thing that we can do unless you want to die from your infections." He sees no way out of this. Dr. Costa has to walk in, has to give him this renewed sense of hope, or there is nothing going on that's any good. Dr. Costa has to believe, has to have the hope, has to provide the hope for Mick to be able to move on with his life in the way he thought he would. And he does that for him. He does that for Kevin, who is down the hall, who's struggling as well. He does that for decades with hundreds of racers in varied, crazy ways because of his ingenuity and his ability to see hope where other people only see broken bones and broken ligaments. Paul is the Dr. Costa of this shipwreck story, right? He is the one who has to see hope for this ship, for these people, for these prisoners, right? Don't forget, it's not just the crew, but there might be 200 prisoners with him on this ship. And who knows the fate that awaits them, but in the meantime, nobody wants to die in a shipwreck. He is in this hopeless situation where they find themselves, but he's standing up and saying, "Nah, this isn't the end of our story." Paul, in this moment, is physically embodying the hope and the joy of the good news of Jesus Christ, right? Paul is proclaiming, our lives are not over, our lives are not forfeit, because the God that I believe in and that I serve said so, and I'm going to believe that, and I'm promising that for you as well. Jesus, in John 10:27, says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. No one can snatch them away from me, for my Father has given them to me, and he is more powerful than anyone else. No one can snatch them from the Father's hand." This is the promise that Paul is standing on. He would know these words because he would have been told them by the people who had lived with Jesus and experienced life with Jesus. Later in John 16, Jesus says, "I have told you all this so that you might have peace in me. Here on earth, you will have many trials and sorrows, but take heart because I have overcome the world." Right? Isn't that powerful? Isn't that the words that we need in the middle of our trouble? 100%. Paul would have taken this, not out of his own strength, not out of his own understandings, but when we look at what the angel says to Paul, it reveals what he must have done. Paul must have been going to God in prayer and just crying out, saying, God, you have got to save us. We are out of hope. We have nothing left. I need you, Paul saying, I need you, God. And these people who are with me need you as well. Because what does the messenger say? What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. See, Paul isn't promising them something that he doesn't know or something that he hasn't already been very involved with. Paul would have been begging God to save not just him, but the people around him. You can't grant something that hasn't already been asked, right? Right? God is responding to Paul. Paul has said, God, you've got to do this because we have nothing left. We've thrown it all overboard. We're readying the lifeboats. What are you going to do, God? Are you going to save us or what? And God shows up and God says, okay, Paul, all right, you want to be a hope marker? You want to be the guy who brings hope to this group of people who are looking at the end of their lives? Okay, you got it. Can you imagine what it would be like to be Paul in this moment, to hear those words from God? I have heard you, and I'm going to give you everything that you ask for. That's what God does. That's what God promises us. That's who we are. I think sometimes we forget this, that God is waiting to grant us these things. All right. Paul is looking for hope for the future, for any kind of future, right? It's looking so hopeless. There are often times that we're looking for hope for our future, am I right? I know the times in my life where I have wondered where my future is going to come from. I can tell you stories of times that I thought there's nothing positive happening moving forward from here. And yet God shows up in crazy ways that you don't expect, that none of us expect. Because he sees us, he hears us, he knows exactly what is going on in our lives. Our storms don't have to be the end of our story. In fact, most of the time they're not. Our storms build faith in us in ways that are unexpected and unusual and maybe not even wanted, right? Let's be honest. Nobody wants the storm. We're not out here begging for the storm. We're not asking for the storm. But Jesus tells us, you're not going to avoid it, man, right? The storm is going to come. What are you going to do in the midst of it? How are you going to survive your storms? Well, if we're going to become hope markers for God's kingdom, which I believe we're being called to, then I think Paul shows us two ways that we need to develop in our lives to survive the storm. The first is this. We need to seek out God in the middle of the storm. I don't know what's happening in your life for some of you. For some of you, I do. I know that there are people here today that are in the middle of storms right now. The most important thing that we can say to you this morning is don't turn your back on the God who will save you. Don't turn your back on the Jesus who has already given up so much for you and sees so much in you and wants to do so much more in your life. It's time to dig in to who God is and what God is doing in your life. It's not time to give that up yet. Be like Paul. Find the place where you can meet with God and say to him, I don't know how we're getting out of this. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't know how the people around me are going to do it. I need you to be the provider and the person and the place where I can run and hide and shelter from the storm. Be looking for the island of rest. Storms are the vehicles where our faith is going to be tested and put into practice. Who are we going to turn to? Are we going to turn to things around us, to people around us, or are we going to turn to the God who promises to take care of us in the storm? Listen, this is not DJ's view of it. This is not your words of hope. These are God's words of hope to our lives. He's calling you. The creator of the universe is calling out to you, saying, don't give up hope. I am here, and I'm ready to be close to you, to be near to you. The second thing, we need to speak up about our hope in the storms. It's tough. It's tough to say, I have faith in God in the middle of things that seem impossible. When the lifeboat has been pulled in and the anchor has been thrown out and everything's overboard, it's hard to say, well, I trust God and I know he's got me on a journey, but I don't know what he's doing. It doesn't have to be the perfect answer. It doesn't have to be well-crafted. You don't have to stand up here and try to impart some kind of wisdom to other people. But you do need to be honest. When people look at you and they say, okay, how are you getting through this? It's fine to say, I don't really know, but I do know that God's in charge and he's got control of it, not me, right? You don't have to have the answers to know that God is for you and with you and holding you and bringing you along. These guys were still shipwrecked. Did you hear that in what Paul said? He promised that the shipwreck was coming, right? And when Pastor Ryan comes back in 2 weeks, I can't wait to hear how he tells that story, because he has to literally like be pulling people in off of the rails saying, don't jump, I promise you are going to live, right? This is not the best news ever, right? I'm sure they're going, hey, Paul, could you tell us that the ship will be fine and we'll just find somewhere to dock up? But he doesn't. He says, listen, you are going to be shipwrecked, but trust me, you are going to get through this. You are going to learn and live and be what you are meant to be. He was honest, he was direct, and he pointed people who to believe in. Not Paul, but God himself. Our willingness or our unwillingness to speak up and live into who God has created us to be communicates everything about our faith to the people around us. And it's tough. It's tough to be on display in front of people. It's tough to know how honest do I be. But if God is the one doing the work, and if God is the one who's protecting you, if God is the one who's building in you this resilience to become stronger and deeper connected and more trusting and more faithful in who you are, you don't have anything to worry about. I don't know what the outcome of your storm is. I don't know if it's positive. I don't know if it's negative. But I do know if that storm brings you closer to God, if that storm builds in you the trust that you need to take another step, another walk, another couple of weeks with God, I know that's a beautiful gift. In the midst of pain and trouble and hurt, that's the best we can hope for, right? Is it? Yes. Do you believe that? Yes. We need you to believe that. God needs you to believe that. God needs you to trust him. He's gonna do the work, but we have got to choose and join in with him, no matter the circumstances around us. It's not some kind of false bravado or like, I'm fine, when we're not. It's okay to say, I'm struggling, but I'm trusting in who God is and the work that God is doing in my life. You can struggle and still believe in God and still have faith and still be moving forward. That's the hope of what Paul is saying here. Don't give up. The ship is going down, but don't give up. Surviving the storm isn't just about my experience or your experience. Surviving the storm means finding faith and hope in the Creator who loves you and is always with you. Hope markers like us, dare to believe that God will do what he says he's gonna do, that we can't be taken from his hand. Hope markers tell others that that is true, that that's who we are, that that's who we're gonna continue to be. If you are a follower of Jesus, this is you. You're being built into hope markers who can give hope to other people because of what God is doing in your life. If you are not yet a follower of Jesus, this is what's possible for you, to find hope, to find healing, to find everything that you need in the God who loves you and is building a kingdom around you with people who are ready to walk alongside of you and show you what that looks like. Genesis, this is the kind of people God is calling us to be resilient, to be faithful followers of Jesus who say, don't give up. It's not the end. There is something else coming, and it will be worth it. It will be. God has got you. He is not giving up on you, and he won't give up on you. We need to be the kind of people like Paul, like Dr. Costa, like countless thousands of others who have said, I believe you, God, and I know that you are going to take care of me. Will you pray with me? God, we believe in your unshakable kingdom. But sometimes it's hard to see. Sometimes the way seems dark and stormy, and we can't find our way. God, I pray in those moments that you would make your voice louder than the storm, that you would send us the people and the messages that we need to hold on for a little longer. God, help us to have hope, not for our sake, God, but for your kingdom's sake, so that we too can be people like Paul who say, God is not done yet. He is still at work here, and he is going to continue to be at work into the future. God, help us to see what is possible with you, to see the ways that you are calling us, that you are gifting us, and that you are leading us to be the leaders of people around us. God, I thank you that you give us so many promises, that you are with us no matter the circumstances. Jesus, we thank you. Thank you that you don't ask us to go anywhere that you didn't already go. Help us to turn to you in our moments of need. Thank you, Jesus.